Now we're thinking ahead to Labor Day weekend, and labor is the theme this week on What's Left. I recently did an interview with Sean Richman, a labor studies professor and activist, who's got a new book on how workers can regain power in the 21st century. I spoke with him last week, and we're going to hear that interview right now. You're listening to What's Left on WMBR in Cambridge. If you compare the current labor movement with the 1930s or the 1960s, or even the 1980s, it seems like the labor movement today appears to be relatively weak and ineffectual. I think those of us who believe in unions, including many union members, feel there's not much movement left in the labor movement. Unions seem to nibble around the edges of the big problems with our economy, like inequality, high-priced health insurance, racial discrimination, and the lack of solidarity among workers, among other problems. My guest has recently published a book that looks into what's happening in unions today, what their organizing model is, and why that needs to change. He lays out an action plan for the labor movement. Sean Richman is the program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College in New York. Before joining that program, he spent many years as a union organizer and representative. His writings have been published in The American Prospect, In These Times, Jacobin Magazine, The New York Daily News, and The New York Times, among other publications. His book is called Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. The book is based on historical research and legal analysis, as well as his own experience as a union organizing director. It challenges some of the labor movement's sacred cows and calls for changes within unions, as well as legislative action to build union representation across America. Sean Richman, thank you for joining me on What's Left.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basic question. It's not a simple question, but I think it's a fundamental one. Why does union density continue to decline? And more than just decline. On the first page of your preface, you say, unions are currently on the edge of institutional annihilation. So why is the percentage of unionized workers so low today?
It's because the system is a trap, and we're also we're really 50 years into a sustained union busting drive by corporate America that was very, very successful. And the nature of the trap is, you know, it's complicated. I think it's sort of wrapped up in the principles of exclusive representation, of bargaining contracts that have no strike clauses. It's wrapped up in the fact that the law smiles upon an employer that bargains its workers to impasse over draconian cuts in their wages and benefits, then can hire scabs to replace them and vote the union out after 12 months. And it were trapped by an NLRB system that was, you know, designed for General Motors in the 1930s, and rules that have been utterly perverted by the employers in this 50-year union busting drive, so that unions are really sort of locked out of the growth industries where you would want labor to be, to have real influence on the economy and on society. It's funny you said compare the labor movement to the 1930s. I think we compare almost perfectly to the labor movement of 1932, which was a real low ebb, and similar dynamics that. You know, there's a sustained union busting drive in the 1920s. Unions were a little bit trapped by old strategies that didn't work for the new economy. And unions were sort of restricted to, you know, construction and mining and garment work. But, you know, we're totally locked out of auto and steel and, you know, these big essential industries where workers needed to have a union.
So you're saying, you're comparing us today to 1932, which was the beginning of the great unionizing drive in this country, right? So are you an optimist?
I'm trying to find moments of optimism.
Well, yes. Good. We need that. Certainly. So good. But you say 50 years of attack. So what you're saying is in 1970, which many people would say was sort of the high watermark of leftist political influence, I mean serious radical political influence in this country, you're saying at that moment the attacks began. Why are you saying that? And how? What happened in the early 70s? To turn the corner.
It was not noticed at the time what was happening. And it started in new union organizing. Unions were organizing. Unions were still utilizing the National Labor Relations Board to have union certification elections, which is sort of the legal process for how you get recognition and begin bargaining. The number of elections did not decline. In fact, it continued to grow. And unions were actually organizing in parts of the country and in industries where they needed to. They were organizing in the South among Black workers. They were organizing in manufacturing. And what happened is the very beginning of sort of global trade and competition was happening, which was not, what we think of today as sort of, cheap products coming in from China or, jobs being outsourced to Mexico. It was actually very high road employers that were competing with us. It was Japan and Germany finally getting on their feet after the war, and their cars starting to really outcompete American cars. Now, and one of the reasons that they could outcompete, irony of ironies, is that they don't have the extra expense artificially loaded onto their payroll of paying for their workers' health insurance, right? Healthcare is the responsibility of the government in those countries. And so, corporate America, rather than embrace social democracy, because why would any American boss do that? They just decided to fight back. And it's funny because there was, for years, corporations wanted to amend the National Labor Relations Act to sort of, quote unquote, level the playing field in the conduct of union elections. And what they discovered is they could just break the law and there would be no repercussions. And so you saw employers start to terminate union activists in order to have a chilling effect. You saw employers make much greater use of these captive audience meetings and to really push the limits of what they could say in there. I mean, they will threaten people's jobs. They will lie about how the process works. We're at the point now where in 1 in 10 cases, they will hire somebody to impersonate an agent of the NLRB and have that person lie about what their rights are.
And that's legal for them to do that?
No, it shouldn't be legal, but there's no repercussions because there's no fines attached to it. And, unions do make, unions make employers spend more money on their workers. So it's worth the risk to employers to just egregiously violate the law to try to keep a union. And so they started doing that in the 1970s, and it was very effective, and they learned all these new tricks. And, and so we think about, we think about Reagan firing the air traffic controllers as the beginning of the busting drive. It wasn't. All that was a signal that this is all perfectly okay. And really what happened then is a copper mining company called Phelps Dodge took the union busting lessons of the 1970s, and they weaponized this Supreme Court decision that was just sitting around since 1938 called McKay Telegraph that gives employers the ability to hire permanent replacement scabs. And they did that. They bargained the union to impasse over very steep cuts in benefits. The union went out on strike. They bust in, thousands of scabs from out of state, put them up in housing, and 12 months later, those scabs voted the union out. And then that became the playbook that de-unionized much of American industry throughout the rest of the 1980s and 90s.
Well, clearly Reagan opened the door to this. He allowed this. He encouraged this. And not just him, but the entire Republican Party came out against labor unions and made that acceptable, politically acceptable. I mean, but I want to talk about the Democrats now because, well, the 1990s in a lot of ways was even worse for the labor movement. And, NAFTA and other trade agreements that were championed by Democratic President Clinton had tremendous effects on the labor movement. Can you talk about that a little bit in terms of how the power of unions was curtailed in the 1990s because of international trade agreements?
Yeah, there's this joke that, you know, some of us in union staff sort of grouse privately about, that the Democrats don't love us like the Republicans hate us. And so it sort of pushes unions into this trap of every election is an existential threat. You just have to throw every possible resource at electing Democrats to Congress and to Senate. And then they just don't get rewarded as a result. You know, labor had a major push to fix the National Labor Relations Act and fix the National Labor Relations Board when Bill Clinton first came into office. And you know, they didn't get it because it was filibustered, because Clinton didn't prioritize it. They couldn't get enough Senate voters. But he did prioritize the NAFTA treaty that I think Bush had actually negotiated. And it's a bad dynamic. I'd like to talk though, just real quick about the labor law reform that unions wanted when Bill Clinton first came into office, because I think it's an example of how unions sort of get stuck in certain strategies. So unions wanted, you know, coming out of this PATCO and Hormel, you know, those years, and seeing employers weaponize the McKay Supreme Court decision, labor wanted a law that would ban the use of permanent replacement scabs. That was the labor law reform bill of the Bill Clinton years, you know, just like the Employee Free Choice Act was the union bill of the Obama years, and now the PRO Act is the union bill of you know, hopefully the Biden years. So it didn't pass, but what we could have done, what we should have done, and what we must do next year is, you know, the NLRB itself could have changed its rules. Part of what happened in the 1980s is that, you know, Reagan and Bush's NLRB sort of acted like a referee in a World Wrestling Federation match, you know? They just looked the other way. Because within the McKay decision, there are two caveats that, you know, there are two tests that an employer must pass in order to be allowed to, you know, to use permanent replacement scabs. Because the language says, you know, that the plain language of this decision, which was just some dumb judge just sort of threw in there as an aside, is just sort of like, because the actual decision protected the right to go on strike. But this judge just says, unless it's necessary, you know, to protect and continue his business, in which case, of course, they should be allowed to permanently replace. So what could and should happen is the NLRB should say, and also that it can't be done in terms of anti-union animus, which is why strikes that are over unfair labor practice charges, workers are protected and can go back to the job. But it shouldn't just be an unfair labor practice charge. You know, an employer that is, you know, insisting on taking away health care, you know, or cutting wages by half, even though that's not an unfair labor practice, that's clearly anti-union. So the NLRB could say, in that case, we're not going to protect your ability to protect staffs. More importantly, it has to be necessary to protect and continue his business. I would like to see the Verizon Corporation open up its books and try to make a case that their multi-billion-dollar business is so marginal that they'll go out of business unless they can hire permanent scab. I want to see United Airlines do that.
Well, is that something that the communication workers or the airlines workers are pushing for?
No, but it's in my book. There's a reason I wrote my book. It's to me, it's a screamingly obvious thing that we should be doing. And it's a thing that Biden could do that he doesn't need the Senate to do.
And why are the unions not pushing for that?
I think that it's just we're in a sort of a strategic cul-de-sac. You know, partly it's just the way that like union organizers and union staff and union leaders learn. You know, you sort of learn by an oral tradition from the people that came before you, which means, you know, if one generation was stuck on one strategy, then that's what's been taught. So, you know, the strikes of the 1980s is that's two generations ago now. So it got forgotten, and strategies to undo it got forgotten is part of the answer. The other part of the answer is, and I say this with love and criticism. I think that there's been a tendency at labor unions, particularly at the international unions, to let the lawyers have the last word on strategy instead of the organizers. And the lawyers have been engaging in a fundamentally conservative, cautious strategy. Because the reality is that you know, we get killed in the courts all the time. Judges are not friendly to workers and to labor unions. And so there's a real a trepidation to do anything that might put an issue into the courts where we could get an adverse decision. But that's just a strategy for losing more slowly. And we do need to take some risks because we're at the verge of institutional annihilation.
I'm speaking with Sean Richman. He's the program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College in New York. And he is also the author of the new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. We're running out of time, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about the current moment. And, you know, how is the labor movement doing during this election season? How well, I mean, I know that a lot of unions have had public education programs over the years, more or less effectively. I would argue pretty much ineffectively for the most part, as they tend to focus on very narrow things and not the big picture about economics and power relations. But right now is a key moment. What is the labor movement doing to educate their members and to educate beyond their membership on the specific issues of this election?
Everything within their power is the short answer.
And how much power do they have?
You know, I mean, it's hard for me to say because of the pandemic issue. I mean, if they had access to their members at the workplace, you know, I think that union get out the vote operations have become incredibly sophisticated. And, you know, the statistics bear this out, that union members vote at a much higher level than ordinary voters. And they vote for Democrats in a much higher percentage than the average voter. And I would also say that, you know, I think unions are really adapting a lot more sort of general economic education and bringing that into their campaigns. I mean, CWA just as a good example. I mean, it's very much on almost like a citizenship school model where they're training their local presidents and shop stewards to do trainings at the workplace about this rigged economy. And I think that's actually very effective stuff. I'm not sure. I'm not working for a union right now, so I can't, you know. If my friends aren't, sort of lying on the internet, I think that they're seeing very high engagement on sort of online town halls or telephone town halls, that members are going out of their way to get the union's message on the election, which is a very encouraging sign.
Right. It's hard for me to see beyond November since we don't know who the president will be and, you know, who will be in charge of Congress. But let's leave with some optimism, the most optimistic that you've got in terms of what the next few years could hold for the labor movement. Well, what would be the best case scenario?
The best case scenario would be we have a Biden administration and he takes some of the, you know, somebody over there reads my book. At a minimum, his NLRB appointees start reversing everything with maximum speed, reverse not only everything that Trump did, but also undoes 50 years of bad rulemaking. And it gives unions just enough leeway to begin organizing. In a serious way, and that organizing encourages more workers to use their power at the job, our ultimate power, which is striking, and that maybe some of these inspirational strikes that we're seeing right now, the sports strikes I'm thinking of in particular, but also a lot of these sort of, you know, strikes for personal protective gear, you know, wildcat strikes at, you know, McDonald's stores, that is striking is contagious. So I'm hoping that we get just enough that it sparks enough change that we actually get, you know, a strike wave, because we're going to need one.
Well, okay, that seems very optimistic to me. But that's great. We need optimism, because we can't sit around and stew. That's been part of the problem, I think, with the labor movement. So I appreciate your book and your time. I've been talking with Sean Richman, author of the book Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century, published in May by Monthly Review Press. Sean, thank you so much for joining us on What's Left.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to WMBR in Cambridge.
England to Poland, every step across the ocean, the ruling classes, them is in a mess. Oh yes, the capitalist system a regress, but the Soviet system now progress.